You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Lechfluenza very kindly actually took me home on the tram on the first night of the curfew. He didn't obviously speak English and I didn't speak Polish, but we simply nodded and exchanged and understood each other. And I'm always grateful to him for that.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
6, 9, 8, 8, 3.
And I'm here to host this final program from the German Democratic Republic for you.
During her visit to Poland in 1980, Jacqueline Hayden met the leading members of the Free Trade Union Solidarity, including the future president Lech Walesa. As a freelance journalist at that time, she reported on the events in Gdansk in August 1980, when the shipyard workers went on strike to demand the creation of free trade unions. Our chat includes some great descriptions of what she saw and heard at the time. It explains the problems facing the nascent free trade union, as well as details of the interview she carried out with General Jaruzelski and Cardinal Joseph Glemp, amongst others. Now, I really do need your help to support my work preserving Cold War history. I deliver 4 episodes a month, and all I'm asking for is $3, £3, or €3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you can get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Jacqueline Hayden to our Cold War conversation. Before we begin this week's episode, I want to highlight our friends at the Cold War channel on YouTube. I've been watching their quality videos for some time and I highly recommend them. The videos are presented in an easily digestible format and cover some fascinating and sometimes little-known Cold War subjects. From the Kyshtym disaster, the biggest nuclear disaster before Chernobyl, to the anti-Soviet guerrilla war in the Baltics, the episodes on Cold War TV provide a fantastic insight into areas of the Cold War not covered elsewhere. Just search for Cold War TV on YouTube. And now, back to our episode.
It's a strange little tale. I was becoming very interested in what was going on in terms of the changes that, you know, you could see happening in Eastern Europe. I had studied history, as I said, in UCD. And we had had the occasion in 1978 of the election of a Polish Pope. And that would have been a big story in Ireland at the time. And in and around the spring of 1980, I was out with a group of journalists and young barristers, and I got into a heated debate with a barrister of my acquaintance who subsequently became a Supreme Court judge, Adrian Hardiman, who sadly died a couple of years ago. But Adrian was of the view that journalists were all lefties. RTE, our national radio station, was full of lefties, and that nothing critical of a communist-oriented or communist-inspired government would ever get covered. And I said to him, don't be blooming ridiculous. I'm sure that if, you know, I went to X country in Eastern Europe, at that, you know, my journalism would be bought and paid for and listened to and read or whatever by whoever I sold it to. And he said, it won't. And he challenged me. And I said, well, do you know, I have been looking for a project. A Polish Pope has just been elected. Now's the time. And he said, well, if you get yourself out there, I will give you £500 to support that endeavour. And all I want is for you to just work for a couple of weeks. So I said, game on. And my first port of call was to work out who would be interested in me stringing for them. And I went into the Old Irish Press, which is sadly no longer with us. It was a very fine paper. And I met one of the feature editors, Campbell Spray, and various other people who commissioned me to do a series of articles on how it was that, you know, what was the background to this new Polish Pope, Cardinal Wojtyla, John Paul, and so that was the start. And then the second and probably the more important thing I did was I really set about contacting anyone that I knew in journalism and in various sort of history departments and things in Dublin who would have had knowledge of Eastern Europe and of particularly Poland. And so I got in touch with lots of people who were connected with dissent, mainly a lot of them based in Paris. And I assembled the names of a whole group of people who, as it subsequently turned out, would be many of the mainstays in solidarity. So I went off at the end of July, went to England, went over to London, I should say, and got a plane to Warsaw with essentially a notebook in my hand and a very long list of addresses and telephone numbers. And one of them in particular, a very famous dissident called Jesse Kuron, lived quite centrally in Warsaw. So I simply got off the plane with my rucksack on my back and arrived at his home, his apartment, only to find that he wasn't there. But there was a young assistant of his who was a PhD student, a German guy. And he said, look, Jacek's not here, but he'd really want to help you because, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening. And I suggest that you get in a cab and go over to the home of Jan Letinski and Christina, because they speak English and they're very involved. They're, you know, great friends of Jacek. And that's what I did. And I went over to that very afternoon. I hopped in a cab and went over to a street in the centre of Warsaw called Ulica Wyzwolenia and found myself knocking on the bell of Janek and Christina Letinski. And Christina is my best friend to this day, my absolute best friend, and Janek too. And that was the start of it.
Wow. That's really interesting. I mean, Jacek Kuron was the head of the Workers' Defence Group, I think.
Yeah, he was a very important dissident and would have been a little bit older than some of the others that I began to meet from. You got to differentiate here between what you might call the intelligentsia, the intellectual dissidents. Many of them sort of post-Marxists, really, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. But Jacek was, you know, subsequently he was Minister for Labour in governments after 1989, but, you know, a giant of solidarity. But before solidarity, he was a giant of CORE, the Committee of Self-Defence. And it was into those circles that I was introduced by Jan and Christina. And literally, their flat was literally the hub for dealing with press queries, for organization. Yannick wrote the underground newspaper Robotnik, The Worker, and his mother used to be effectively the chief typist. So she'd be sitting there in the apartment with, you know, balancing this old Remington with Galois fags, cigarettes hanging out of her mouth. And she would have been elderly at that time. But it was like entering into... It was like something for somebody as young as I was at the time. It was like walking onto a Cold War movie set or something. You know, it was just amazing, and their kindness was incredible. You know, so that was the very. I mean, I never went home that night. They kept me. I kind of slept on the floor. And they didn't think it was a good idea because I was sort of staying in just a student sort of hostely type place, and they thought I looked like a little bit of a naive fresh Irish girl to be left in that situation, which naturally was greatly to my benefit. And so from there, Yannick offered to take me with him to Gdansk, and. He was doing several things. Firstly, he was organizing what would become the union, but it was obviously points of opposition, going into factories, going into meetings, sort of not overtly, obviously, very quietly. And so apart from bringing me to various meetings, the big thing that he did for me was to bring me in the early part of late July, early August, up to Gdansk. And that's where I had the most amazing experience of meeting more or less the entire presidium of the what would become the free trades unions of the coast in Anna Valentinovich's flat in a sort of suburb of Gdansk.
Wow. Talk about being in the right place at the right time.
It was incredible. I mean, to this day, I sat there, and one of the things that I always remember is thinking about who the key people were. And oddly, I mean, people now have different assessments, and there are many controversial sort of takes and analysis of Lech Wałęsa, but in that room, and because I was allowed back to meetings over several days, and Anna might have been trying to run a revolution, but she also was hugely personally kind. At that stage, I found her very, very, very warm, and you know, she would be giving out poppy seed cake and lemon tea to anyone who came into that flat. But the sort of people who were in that room were people like Ange Gwiazda. Ange Gwiazda would have been one of the very senior people who, in the what would become the free trades unions of the coast, and his wife Joanna, Bogdan Borisevich, who would later become the marshal in the Sejm, and Elena Piankowska, his wife, who actually with Anna were the two women who stopped the strike from being, as it were, being stopped before it started. If you follow, there's a sort of a famous story about them. But Alina was a nurse in the shipyards, and also present were people like Bogdan Lis. So there was a kind of the core group that would eventually be associated with the free trades unions of the coast were present, yeah. And obviously others coming in and out. But Lech Wałęsa was, of course, there. But it was only after a little while that I really began to kind of get the hierarchy of what was going on in that room. And because Anna was, she was older and she had such experience, and she was the crane driver. She had been other roles in the shipyard, but it was her, and it was her sacking that had led to the strikes in the first place. But it was just, as I reflect on it, I didn't come away thinking that Lech Wałęsa was the leader until it was afterwards that became apparent. And of course, that then subsequently led to a lot of disputes in Solidarity many years later. But there was, I suppose, one of the reasons I got to know President Wałęsa relatively well was that at that point in those meetings in Gdańsk, in the flat, after a couple of days, a curfew was imposed. So leaving their apartment, but needing to get back. And Lech Wałęsa very kindly actually took me home on the tram on the first night of the curfew. And he didn't obviously speak English, and I didn't speak Polish, but we simply nodded and exchanged and understood each other. And I'm always grateful to him for that. It was just a personal courtesy that meant a lot to me at the time, obviously.
That's amazing. And I mean, how did Lech Wałęsa come across to you? I mean, what was he like as a personality? I mean, I've heard him described that he could, you know, warm up a room in no time. He was such an effective, I'm trying to think of a word for it, communicator, I guess. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing about Lech Wałęsa. If I talk about that first time, that first meeting in the apartment, what came over was a person with amazing twinkly eyes and a sense of humor, even though this was desperately serious stuff, you know. And all of these people were used to being harassed and in and out of jail, but how he came over was as a very warm person for a start. At that meeting, as I say, I didn't think of him as the leader, because to me what I was looking at was a committee of people, and Anna was very powerfully present in the room, as was Ange Gwiazda. And you know, when people read the story of Solidarity and how it eventually it fragmented, the strains of those differences, as I reflect now, can be seen from all of the individuals in the room, that they in their separate ways did end up in separate parts of the union, which if you start trying to retrospectively understand even today's contemporary politics of the Law and Justice Party, PiS, under Mr. Kaczynski, and of course his brother the president dying in the Smolensk crash. Anna Valentinovich died with him in that crash, and it was that wing of Solidarity that she later became part of, but I wouldn't have understood that at the time. You know, all I saw was this united group of people, whereas what we know subsequently is that Solidarity broke on all kinds of lines. Modernity, you know, the pluralist politics, issues of you know, secular versus a dominantly Catholic version, and nativism, you know, to do with a notion of what Poland should be about. But I suppose what I'm trying to say here is that all of that was there in that room, in that apartment, but not clearly visible to me at that stage as a 23-year-old who simply saw, called them whatever, you know, freedom fighters, potential revolutionaries or whatever.
And I have this vision of this cramped, smoke-filled flat.
Oh, there was a lot of smoking. Yes.
Did you meet Danuta, Wałęsa's wife, as well?
Funny enough, I did not meet her then. I didn't, because, as you know, they would have had they had a lot of children, and so when Lek came to those meetings at that stage, Danuta wasn't there. But I did meet her subsequently, actually, but many years afterwards in Dublin at a seminar where she spoke about her book. On that trip, on that first visit to Poland, I met a number of people, and one of the people that really impressed me was Zbyszek Bujak. He was an electrician from the Ursus factory, but he subsequently, in years afterwards, he became the leader of the Solidarity Underground, and I was introduced to him very early on in my visits by Janusz Onuszkiewicz, who many people would know as the British educated mathematician who was the voice and the spokesman of Solidarity from 1980 onwards. But most especially people would remember his face from 1989 from the roundtable talks. But Zbyszek Bujak was a really, really, really special person, and he was very close to my friends, the Latinskis. So he was another incredibly decent. It's just hard to describe sort of the sense I had at the time of just meeting such decent heroes, you know?
Because he was the Solidarity leader that managed to stay on the run the longest, I think, under martial law.
Yes, he did. He escaped and therefore led Solidarity into the underground. And indeed, I have to say, I remember one particular interview with him. One of the later interviews I did with him, he's a very open and honest person, and his insights into the pressure on families that was created by the men being underground, you know, was deeply honest, actually, because it's a delicate matter, but obviously when people's private lives are very shuffled up and they're on the run, you know, people perhaps form war relationships, for the want of a better word. But he was one of the people that, as a man, I found it very interesting to talk to about that issue, because he wasn't trying to hide it or cover it up. And you know, he said it did put a lot of stress on women, both the women who were left overground and the women who perhaps fell into relationships underground. And it was just, I have to say, I have huge respect for him, for his honesty.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You know, having that openness from somebody, and, you know, hearing what you in your heart knows, he's actually telling me the truth here. He's not trying to sugarcoat this.
No. And it was something that some of the, you know, the women that I would have spoke to over the years would have referred to. But it was a difficult matter to, it wasn't every male activist that necessarily wanted to sort of discuss that part of things, you know?
Yeah. But it's a, you know, it's an aspect of being underground that people don't necessarily, you know, think of or have heard about, because people don't talk about it.
No, that's the truth.
Just going back to 1980 and those meetings in that flat, did, you know, the leadership or those people think they were actually going to be able to get a free trade union at that point?
I often think about that. I think nobody was expecting that essentially something that was dealing with very immediate demands was going to turn into something which was essentially the genesis of the collapse in 1989. But it is interesting to remember that the women in particular, and when I say the women, I mean Alina Pien, the late Alina Pienkowska, and Anna Valentinovich, were really quite central in framing the demands in a more human rights type characterization, rather than just we want to get back to work and we don't want these price increases. The initial demands, which were so much more modest, but you've also got to remember that apart from what happened initially in relation to the strike, or the beginnings of the strike, the really important development is when you have the people from CORE coming to support the workers. Because if the genesis of the collapse of communism in Poland is to be understood in any frame, it has to be that it was this unique coming together of the church, dissident intellectuals, the intelligentsia, and activist workers. And so when I went up and was assisted to get to Gdansk by Jan Latinsky, that was literally what he was doing there, was going to be part of the intelligentsia support for the workers, to help them with things like publishing their underground newspapers. In other words, publishing details about the what was happening with the strikes. So in the weeks that followed, I suppose basically from about the second week in August, you had the likes of Tadeusz Mazowiecki, a player in the 1989 Round Table and subsequent politics, but also Bronisław Geremek, as I said, the people like Janusz Onuszkiewicz, Jacek, my friend Jan Latinsky. They became key advisors to the strikers, and in so doing, it meant that the government, in the form of the communist government negotiators, were not just dealing with brave workers. They were dealing also with the intellectual support of dissidents such as Geremek, such as Mazowiecki, etc., who came ultimately became, those two in particular, became the seriously close advisors to Lech Wałęsa.
Right. Right. So when you say they were sort of using human rights demands, were they using the Helsinki Accords or details of that?
Well, I mean, it was the beginning. It was, you know, the point is that the characterization of the demands developed over that month with the input of Bronisław Geremek, sorry to cut across myself, was until his recent death, a very well known historian. So there was a lot of intellectual underpinning that was there to support the characterization of the demands. And so what I'm saying is that the awareness of human rights norms and expressing demands in terms of such norms was something that was.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
It was natural or obvious to the intellectual dissidents, you know, who had been very active. I mean, certainly from the mid-70s. I mean, you can trace CORE back to earlier than that, but people normally talk around 75, 76 is when the Committee of Self-Defense was set up. And it was, of course, based on principles, legal and human rights principles, and their objectives were based on those I suppose, what you could call the principles we now associate with, you know, post-enlightenment modernity, if you want to express it in a posh fashion. But that's essentially what those people brought to the table in Gdansk. And when I say to the table, I mean to the table where the negotiation on the 21 demands was being conducted.
Yeah. Yeah. You said earlier that there was a period where the strike might have failed.
It's a very, there's an awful lot of controversy in and around, I suppose, the role of Lech Wałęsa, and indeed on whether or not Solidarity 1980 has, and what it promised, was vindicated by the solidarity that emerged after 1989. I mean, essentially, if you want to understand the political landscape in Poland today and the deep cleavage that is underpinned by a row over how you interpret the round table and whether it was a sellout by elements of solidarity to the communist side, and that in fact it doesn't represent a revolution, that it represented almost a kind of a negotiated deal whereby the communists got to retain power. I mean, that's essentially the the kind of discourse that is that is central to the current Law and Justice PiS government's assertions about, you know, yeah, that Wałęsa sold out solidarity.
But it's easy to look at that in retrospect, yes, though, to come up with that interpretation.
Yes, but you see, I suppose one of the things I've done in my academic work since then is to try and understand where this comes from. And it does come from the fact that you had such different constituencies, for the want of a better word, in that room in Gdansk, but in other parts of the Free Trade Union of the Coast, of the rural solidarity, of all of the different branches of solidarity that came together. I mean, it is a cliche for me to say that solidarity was an umbrella. It was an umbrella under which so many different interests took cover. And it was an umbrella with which under which people who shared one common aim, which was to essentially overthrow communism in Poland. But of course, after 89, you see the breakup of that, because what you see is that people have different interests, as they do in any society. And what I'm trying to say is that I can look back now and I can say to you, well, I met Władysław Frasyniuk at that same time when I was in Poland in 1980. He was down in Wałbrzych, down in near Wrocław, and he would have been characterized as a worker solidarity person, but he has ended up in the liberal end of the post-solidarity parties, whereas Anna Valentinovich and the Gwiazdas essentially maintained that the solidarity revolution was robbed, that it was stolen, that Wałęsa was an agent Bolek, famously characterized. And that, in turn, you see, as I said when we were talking earlier, I mentioned that Anna Valentinovich died on the plane crash in Smolensk, when they were on their way to commemorate the Katyn massacre. But the fact that she was on a plane with Kaczynski, it tells you about the branch of the post-solidarity groupings that she moved to, that she identified with, whereas Frasyniuk and Wałęsa and Onyszkiewicz and all those other people, they were inclined towards essentially a liberal, both economic liberal and from the perspective of social issues, a liberal wing of that umbrella. So I'm saying that the fragmentation was there, and in, you know, you can see it in, personified in the people that were in that room. But what that was covered simply because there was one aim, there was one goal.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, what's your view on the Valença Bolek?
I think a number of things. I think it was probably hard to be anybody connected with an enterprise in the 1970s and not have had your collar touched by a member of the secret police. And I don't think that makes Lech Wałęsa a communist agent or spy.
No.
And there are too many people who I would know and trust as people who would not take that view. And yes, he might have had, he may have had conversations with secret police, but, you know, this issue is so complicated and is underpinned by all sorts of score settling and rows. But when you look at what I would call the sane end of the people that I met in that room in 1980, Bogdan Borisevich, Alina Pienkowska, and other people like Bogdan Lis, they certainly did not take the view that Lech Wałęsa sold out the Solidarity. I just think it's nuanced and it's complicated, and that storyboard has been used very effectively by those who want to say that 1989 and the Round Table was a sellout.
Yeah, it sort of fits the narrative. I mean, you'd be surprised if there wasn't a file on him, to be honest.
Well, that's the point. I mean, the you would be surprised if there wasn't a file. I mean, all of these people would have been subjected in some shape or form. My friend Christina was a regular part of their lives to have secret police banging on the doors, coming to their home, being arrested, being in jail. You know, how many people must have, in some shape or form, said something just to get themselves out of a situation? It doesn't make them traitors.
No, and I think that this is the thing. It's easy for people to look at it in certain ways, but when you're actually in that situation and somebody is threatening the safety of your family or loads of other things, what would you do in that situation? And I'm pretty certain I would probably act the coward and I would have given them the information. Just to go back to Gdansk in 1980, were you there when the agreement was signed?
I was actually down in Krakow by that stage. So I was in Poland, but actually away. And one of the reasons for that was that I was with Yannick on a number of occasions, and I started to feel the attention of the security services. I was getting followed. It was becoming a little bit scary. And Christina, my friend in particular, was anxious that I take a breather before something unfortunate happened. And I went with a very well-known Dutch journalist called Dick Verkeek, who was one of the Dutch journalists that went in with the American forces into Auschwitz. And so I actually went from Gdansk to Warsaw and then went down to Krakow, which is very near Auschwitz. And so I was there at that time, but I was also working to interview as many people connected with Solidarity in that region. And indeed, I also went to Krakow because one of the people who had been very close to Cardinal Wojtyla, worked for a newspaper, Tygodny, actually I can't pronounce it, so I won't say it, but worked for the one of the Catholic newspapers in Krakow. And so I spent some time interviewing people there, and in particular his daughter Rasha Vashnikevska. So I was in the south at the time of the actual agreements, but then came back up to Warsaw, and then subsequently also spent a good bit of time on subsequent trips, like nearer to like the end of November, December. I was in Poland again, and that was very interesting because Yannick in particular, I was able to accompany. He was essentially speaking to workers' groups and helping them set up branches of Solidarity. And I remember traveling with him down to his own what would be his own constituency after 1989, Vaubscher in the Wrocław region, and going out to Świdnica to some of the factories, and being present for meetings, which was essentially helping workers to organize branches of the union, which was really absolutely fascinating. I'll never forget, there was one place where it was 20 feet deep in snow. I remember thinking that I was just going to die of frostbite before I got my stories back, you know. I'd been sent back for a second visit by the Irish Press at that stage, and in fact the Irish Times had commissioned me as well because they liked the first work I'd put out in August.
And how were you getting your stories back? Were you recording them or writing them?
No, at that stage I was writing. And I was, until the phone lines in Yannick Litinsky's house apartment were blocked, I was getting them out that way. I was ringing, and then I was, and obviously when I came home in the middle of August, I produced some articles, the ones commissioned for the Irish Press, and then I was commissioned by the old Sunday Tribune, the Irish Times, for the November-December visit, where I did the real job they wanted me to do there was to look at how the union was being established in the region. So that involved an awful lot of moving around the country, and so I would use the the telex and the facilities that would have been afforded to me by the Polish authorities at the time, because I remember there was a period of freedom, particularly after the Gdansk Agreement in the 31st of August. So there was a period before, in the coming months when you were being supported to some extent by the press office, the government press offices.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. You said that you were being followed by the SB, the Polish secret police. Where were you staying?
I was staying with Yannick and Christina, and there were several occasions. So I remember in particular, it was in and around the old Victoria Hotel in central Warsaw. And there was also a very famous hotel called the Europejski, which is near Nowy Swat. And a lot of the foreign journalists, particularly some of the British ones, Michael Dobbs and Manchester Guardian, I remember, Dessa Trivison from The Times, several of them were staying there. And I remember at one stage feeling that the police were getting so close to me, and I felt so kind of under pressure. I just ran into the Europejski, and I knew that they were, I can't remember the number of the room, but I remember it was on the first floor, I think. And I remember running up the grand staircase and just going in and shouting, "My name's Jacqueline Hayden and I'm an Irish journalist." And it was just, I felt, oh my God, I've just displayed, I'm a child, you know. And but they were really kind. I got to know Michael very well, actually. He was so supportive and helpful, really helpful. But I was with Yannick a few times on the street when, you know, they'd be so close you could close you could feel their breath. And it was, that was then that Christina said, Jack, you know, I think you should go get out of here for a few days. And that's when I went down with Dick Verkaik down to Krakow, and we went to Auschwitz. But and when I left the first time, I actually had because it was ordinary old, you know, box camera and everything. So I put my little rolls of film in my socks. I truly felt like a spy in my boots, and that's how I carried my few photos out. I did that on more than one occasion, I can tell you. And I was there on a visitor's visa. That was my other problem. In a way, I could have been legitimately arrested. But so I carried my minimal tools of my trade, in my clothing, basically.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, it sounds like such heady times and so much hope in the country as well.
I was very young, and I remember walking in and seeing Regina, Yannick's mother, as I mentioned earlier, you know.
With the Gauloises, yeah.
With the Gauloises and with the Remington and her work. And it was just, I just felt this powerful feeling of these people are so determined, and here am I, you know, bourgeois, you know, everything going, you know, life is easy. And you know, I remember the second time I visited Christina saying to me, you know, well, we loved you because you did two things. You did bring the toilet rolls, but you also recognized I was a woman and you brought me some perfume. And so it wasn't just all, you know, basic things. And we kind of, I just had such respect for them, because in any other world at that time, I mean, these were hugely talented people. My friend Christina was a child psychologist, a really brilliant person from a village up in, called Czarna, up in the north of Poland. And Yannick was a really, is an amazingly bright and intellectual person. And, you know, they could have just gone along with it and they would have done very well. Thank you very much. So I just felt this enormous sense of privilege. And I think that that was something that was felt by others. There's a very well-known British journalist called Tim Sebastian, who was covered the strikes a lot, and he was onto the apartment one night when I was there, and it was just when curfew was beginning to happen in Warsaw, and we were getting very worried that the phones would be put down. And I remember just talking to him briefly for a few minutes, but you could tell the respect and awe that he had in his voice for Christine and Yannick, because they would have been huge, you know, they were, the flat was the hub for dealing with the press. And he very kindly took a message just to tell him, I was just recently married, to tell my husband that I was a bit lost, but I wasn't dead or anything. So he very kindly rang up RTE in Dublin and passed that message on. But it was just a time when, if you met journalists who knew the dissidents well, it was a very respectful, in awe relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, and these people are just taking such huge risks.
Yeah, because they're in jail. I mean, it was. You know, when I talk to the amount of times that people were in and out of jail, and when we read books about, you know, the different regimes in communist Eastern Europe, you know, people use terms like, you know, one was harsher, one was whatever. At the end of the day, which of us would ever have liked to have, as my friend Christina did, spent her Christmas, you know, after martial law in jail, in a room with no windows, with snow and ice sitting on the ledge and nothing but the company of women in a crowded cell to keep spirits up. Who would want that for themselves? And that's why, you know, talking about sort of more benign forms of communism or more one regime as opposed to another, it's wonderful, except if you're living it.
Yeah, yeah. And when you were talking to them, obviously they had hope that things were going to change, but did they ever say it will probably be 20 years before things change or something like that? Did they have a timeline in mind at all or not?
I think different. I think different people had different notions. I mean, the one thing I'm always very conscious of is that if you think about it from the perspective of sort of academic literature or journalistic writing, there was nobody predicting the demise of communism in 1989. And I know in particular from there was one series of conversations that I had with Janusz Januszkiewicz, who became the first non-communist and non-military. He was Minister for Defence in the first government. And Janusz was the Oxford-educated mathematician who was the spokesman for Solidarity. And I spoke to him, two sets of elections in first round and second round in 1989. June 4th was the first one. And when, in speaking to him then, I remember absolutely his shock at the result of the election. He said they were not ready for government. They did not want to govern. They simply weren't prepared. And that, if you think about that, that within literally a number of weeks, the end of August, whenever it was, 1989, you have the first a coalition between the various parties, and you have Jaruzelski then elected as president. That all of that happened so quickly to people who had thought of literally incremental steps and change.
Mm.
And I said earlier that in 80 there were some people looking at just the immediate issues of getting people out of jail because they'd been jailed for protest, reducing price hikes, which had led to the hardship, which in turn was another factor in the strike. And then there were those who were trying to frame it as, in other words, to soften the regime in terms of, as we discussed, a human rights perspective. So you've got that then, but nobody is sitting thinking that the end of the regime is nigh. And when you speak to people about their perspective in and around 85, 86, 87, just before the regime began to overtly seek a negotiation with people from Solidarity, around the period when it was happening for very good reasons, because the Soviet regime itself was beginning to crack. It could no longer financially support its commitments to the Eastern Bloc and all the other international factors that were happening at that time. When you talk to people, for instance, like Adam Michnik, about what was happening, say, in relation to, I suppose, the softening, you know, the ending of the Brezhnev doctrine, the beginnings of the opening up in Russia. Nobody was interpreting those in a kind of in an immediate time frame. It was very difficult to know what was actually going on. What did perestroika actually mean? What was Gorbachev? What was Gorbachev actually doing? And particularly Adam Michnik, and particularly Janusz Januszkiewicz, always said in interviews, with me that you cannot look back and say, well, clearly he was signaling from about 1984, 85 that changes were coming. And they would say there were so many other voices saying other things that there was too much noise in and around that space for any Polish dissident or Solidarity member to identify, in other words, what was the seeds of collapse. It's far too much a retrospective analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. I was interested in some of the people you interviewed in later years, like the early 90s.
Yes.
You spoke with General Jaruzelski.
Yes.
What was that like?
I met with General Jaruzelski on a couple of occasions, and they were very, very, very long interviews. And I had initially met with his spokesman, Jan Bestiga. And I think that was how, in the end, I managed to get the interview with General Jaruzelski, because I had interviewed Bestiga on a number of occasions. And he was fascinating in terms of how you saw people who had been totally behind the Polish United Workers Party changing their stripes when the transition happened. And I was very conscious.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
In the interviews with General Jaruzelski, from the earliest ones to the later ones, that he was very conscious of wanting to inform the public record about himself. Again, a hugely controversial figure. He was personally a pleasant person to interview. He was always courteous. He wasn't a rough man in any way. He was always at pains to explain his own sense of honour and what his loyalties were to. And he would have always expressed that in terms of his loyalty to the Polish military. And others would sort of say, well, he would, wouldn't he? Because that is his way of exonerating his role in various activities, including, you know, the introduction of martial law and the violence that was associated with it, earlier violence that was associated with suppression of various activities and strikes, etc., in the 80s. But I have to say that I do believe that he was genuine in his dealings with the Solidarity leaders and the Solidarity negotiators in and around the period running up to and, you know, after the around the round table. And I think that because I do believe he was a very intelligent man, and whatever he did or didn't do in the past, he saw change and he saw the possibility of being able to bring something over the line with the likes of Wałęsa, Mazowiecki, Bronisław Geremek and others. I mean, I asked him, I suppose I interviewed him for long on three. I met him on more than these occasions, but I interviewed him at length on three different occasions, 92, 99 and 2007. And his story didn't change. And I'm always struck by a photograph that you may or may not have seen, which was published a number of weeks before he died. And it's a picture of General Jaruzelski in bed, in hospital, the famous sunglasses on, and shaking his hand is Lech Wałęsa. And to me, there's a lot of ways of reading that. To me, it's a very symbolic photograph, which could be interpreted as a reconciliation and acceptance of the nature of what the Round Table was, which was a political deal to produce a result without violence. Others simply say that was, you know, the two traitors shaking hands. I personally don't see it that way.
No. I mean, Jaruzelski is an interesting character because the reason for the tinted glasses was he was in a Soviet labor camp and his eyesight was damaged there. So,
but his eyesight was damaged by frost glare, the glare.
Yeah,
that you
snow
get
blindness. From, yeah. Yeah. So he was almost, well, I can't recall exactly why he was in the labor camp, but obviously he ended up the wrong side of the Soviet authorities. So he's not what you think when you actually go back and look at his full story.
Is he a hero or a traitor is a kind of a simplistic way of expressing it. And in fact, in my earlier book, I had a chapter on Jaruzelski. And, you know, it's very easy. Let me put it this way. Politics is often regarded as a dirty game, but it's a great alternative to people shooting each other. And the fact that a deal was done by somebody of Jaruzelski's level, who's undoubtedly a Polish military person, but who had an allegiance to the philosophy or of a foreign power, i.e. the Soviet Union. The fact that he was proud to have taken part in that negotiation and that the result it gave, he accepted, and he while he would have on occasion said, you know, that if they had done things differently, they might have ended up with a negotiation that would have left the communists with in a better position. But nonetheless, it was honored. And to me, that's what politics is. So I don't have Polish blood in my veins, so I can't feel the pain that people whose family was killed or assaulted or beaten by troops that General Jaruzelski ordered out. I can't feel that. But what I can respect is the desire to make a deal work that would, and I believe it was his view, create a better Poland.
Yeah, and it's always tricky because, as we said earlier, you look at these things with hindsight, and it's always difficult to get into the shoes of somebody who was there at the time and the information that they had to hand. Because, you know, you take the example of martial law being declared in December 81. There was sort of a reasonably high likelihood that the Soviets were going to intervene. Polish history in terms of fighting invasions, it wouldn't have been Czechoslovakia 68 where people wouldn't have fought. It would have been bloody if the Soviets had come in without a doubt. And yes. I'm sure that's what Jaruzelski was looking at and thinking, there's two evils here. This is the lesser of two.
Well, I agree with you completely, and I've spent a bit of time trying to read the documentation and the material that was released in Russia in the early mid-90s, all about, you know, who knew what from the Politburo, who was talking to whom in Warsaw. And of course, you know, there are those that will argue that that Jaruzelski was the one that was doing the dirty work, and that the Soviets weren't going to invade, but he was using that as his raison d'être for doing so. again, it's a bit similar to the point I was making earlier about, you know, what people understood in Poland about what Gorbachev was doing with perestroika and with the opening up, and whether or not it what was it a signal of. I think that in times of limited information and huge uncertainty, and where it is very difficult to be totally clear about what the strategic intentions and the capacity of various players and actors is, that in this case, I think that it makes logical sense to me that Jaruzelski did believe that if he didn't contain with martial law, that something worse was going to happen. But as I say, that is just my analysis, having done my best to understand the documentation that is now available.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And another character you spoke to was General Kiszczak.
Kiszczak, yeah. He's the man who ordered the death of Father Popiełuszko in 1984.
Because he's quite a controversial character, isn't he?
Very. General Kiszczak was the interior minister who was responsible, as I said, who was responsible for the murder or arranging the murder of Father Popiełuszko. And he is an extremely controversial figure. And while he was a player at the time of the Round Table, I think that his view, and the one thing that fascinated me about my interview with him was that he was reading at the time some counterfactual analysis of what would have happened had a different electoral system being used in the first and second round of the Round Table, the first and second round of the elections in 1989. And I don't want to get too technical on this because it's to do with basically using, straight past the post, first past the post, as opposed to more proportional systems. And I have done some work on this, but essentially, had a different electoral system been used, it is most unlikely that this Solidarity landslide would have happened. And what General Kiszczak, when I met him, was saying about this was very, very interesting, because he was characterizing this as proof that they did not have to essentially, they didn't have to lose the vote, and therefore the end result could have been different. Now, as I said, he was very much a hard line. He was very much the henchman of the regime, and he is not somebody who I think whom history has been particularly kind to, etc. But he undoubtedly made it clear to me that he regretted, deeply regretted, the mistakes that were made in the negotiation on the communist side during the Round Table, which led to this electoral outcome, which he truly believed could have been avoided.
That is really interesting. That I hadn't heard that there were other electoral systems being contemplated there.
It's something that I actually did quite a bit of work on. There's a great Polish political scientist called Marek Kaminski, who first wrote the paper, which essentially was a counterfactual analysis of the differential effect of voting systems on the outcome in 1989. And in fact, one of the things that I really tried to understand for a book I did on the collapse of communist power, looking at it from the perspective of what the communists negotiated, I was able to establish by talking to various experts and academics that essentially Jaruzelski was told that they should have used an alternative voting system. Mr. Rakowski, the last prime minister, said to me he didn't know what they were thinking when they went ahead with the voting system, because they had been told They had advice from Professor Ange Verblan direct to General Jaruzelski, telling them to use an alternative voting method. But one of the problems was, as Miroslav Rakovsky, the last prime minister, said to me, was that he said we were caught in a frame of mind where we always won, but we'd forgotten that the rules had changed. And we were relying, he said, on opinion polling, which, of course, was opinion polling under conditions of unfreedom, where everyone said, yes, they wanted to vote for the party. And Miroslav Rakovsky said that to me in one of the earliest interviews. And he said it was just one of the most tremendous mistakes of the roundtable negotiation. There were others, but that's a pretty big one.
Have you seen that Netflix series, 1983?
I haven't, actually.
Have you heard of it?
I've heard, yes, I have, but I haven't.
It's really interesting. It's like, you know, communism hasn't fallen in Poland, and it's sort of taking place in 2003, and there's an uprising. But it's an interesting counterfactual.
I love the counterfactuals.
Yeah, no, so I love the what ifs, and if the elections after the roundtable hadn't been a solidarity landslide is an amazing what if. Wow.
Yes. It's a very there's a couple of other parts to that counterfactual analysis, and it relates to the negotiating position of the communist side negotiators. And one of the mistakes they made was agreeing to the setting up of the new office of president, because eventually, of course, that was something that Wałęsa won. And again, it was all these incremental steps that created this sense of massive change. The other point was that they set up the Senate, and the voting system they chose for that ended up with basically all members bar one being from Solidarity. It's an interesting analysis of the bargaining position of the Communist Party negotiators, that they relied on poor information, number one, that their negotiating strategies were not fully informed, number two, and that often, crucially, they ignored advice, as in the case when General Jaruzelski actually ignored the advice from Professor Ange Verblan, who wrote to Rakovsky setting out a whole set of conditions about what the electoral institutions should be. And they were ignored because, in my view, as Mr. Rakovsky said to me, because we were still thinking under the old conditions, we were still thinking the old rules applied, but the game had changed.
So did the ultimate decision around the electoral systems be the Communist Party's decision, or was that negotiated as to what electoral system?
It was negotiated, but, you know, the roundtable had a number of competences, but they were, you know, they were called, there was the political table, there was the economic table, the social table. So they were like comp tables with different competences where negotiations went on. But these institutional negotiations were, I've analysed them in detail, you know, the decision to set up a Senate, the decision to have a universally elected president, and then the other decisions about the SEM, how it would be elected. And essentially, I mean, without going into detail, the Communist Party side negotiated rules that were the least optimal for them. They were the ones that gave them this landslide against them. Whereas, Professor Kaminski argues in with great ability and great detail, you know, even slightly modified voting rules would have given a different outcome, which in turn could have impacted on the effect of this, you know, a domino, this effect of it being such a crushing defeat. And it wouldn't have been if it had been under a different set of electoral rules. It's why, actually, in subsequent Polish institutional rulemaking, they have modified their electoral systems on many occasions in the 90s, and even the Constitution itself wasn't ratified for many years because the lessons of the impact of the minutiae of the rules that one uses for electoral purposes, that, you know, they do matter. They're what people think of as niggly, boring rules, but they had a profound impact on the trajectory of transition in Poland.
So did the Solidarity negotiators know what the optimum form of voting would be for them?
I don't believe that they were as concerned about it because they didn't anticipate the victory. I think they were focused on other things. But when you talk to academics about those institutional decisions, I think it's reasonable to interpret what they argue is that you would have expected the communist side to have been very careful about the rules it chose, because they were trying to retain power, presumably. And yet, they literally ignored expert advice from within their own ranks that would have steered them in a completely different direction.
Just a couple of things I wanted to just ask you about. Adam Michnik's an interesting character. I mean, he's a long-term opposition activist, I think, from the 1960s, but he defends Jaruzelski and Kiszak against prosecution.
Well, he formed a very... Adam Michnik would have had a very good relationship with General Jaruzelski. And perhaps I'd like to characterise how I understand, in the context of other history... Adam Michnik would, I think, take the view that a deal was done between General Jaruzelski, with Kiszczak being probably almost, to understand it, I'm thinking of our own Irish history here and our treaty, which caused our civil war, you know, in 1921. And there is a perspective that says it doesn't matter who you did the deal with. And in the Irish case, it would be with perfidious Albion, you know, it would be with Britain, that the deal was agreed and that the individuals and their historical legacy is not the issue, that it was agreed that there would not be prosecutions after the agreement, and that General Jaruzelski and even Kiszczak should not be prosecuted, because that was the bargain. And that goes back to what I was saying about, I suppose, the idea of politics as a much better device for people managing to live together rather than people shooting each other. There could have been a very violent change in Poland, and there wasn't. Nor was there in the Czech Republic, Hungary, you know, and you either respect, the idea of the deal, and that the deal involves an agreement about what happens to those who are on the, you know, inverted commas, losing side. And that, I think, would be almost where it begins and ends with Adam Michnik.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Really interesting. Can we just touch on Cardinal Glemp?
Yeah.
Because we haven't really talked that much about the Catholic Church, yet you did some interviews with Cardinal Glemp, who was the head of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
From 81, I think, till 2009.
In talking about the role of the Catholic Church, it cannot be underestimated in terms of its importance in this idea of that what Solidarity and was about, and what 1989 was about, was this coming together of these three branches of Polish society: the church, the intellectual dissidents, and indeed the workers, and that's what made it a unique revolution. But again, if you look, there isn't just one church in Poland. There is, you know, there is the church of Father Josef Tischner, the Cracovian philosopher of Solidarity, and then there is the Cardinal Glemp version of Catholicism. And Cardinal Glemp was a hardline fundamentalist Catholic leader, And whereas Father Tischner was very much in a different school of Catholicism. But both of those voices are part of Catholics Poland, and they're part of Solidarność, you know. Glemp was extremely important, as were other bishops in the negotiations with Jaruzelski. And Jaruzelski would have spoken a lot about his relationship with members of the hierarchy. In fact, one thing that I really discovered in conversation with General Jaruzelski and from talking to people like Glemp was that the mistake that some of the communists made was that they thought that because they had this arrangement whereby they could talk to the communists, they could be the voice of solidarity with the communists, and as many, you know, people would observe, that they got close enough that they would have meals and they would have, you know, they would have had glasses of vodka with communists, and with and that very much was the case. It was this sort of personal relationship that worked, as it were, between General Jaruzelski and Glemp. But that it led again Jaruzelski into thinking that the church would actually speak in some way in support of the Communist Party in the first free elections. And that was another shock to Jaruzelski. And he said that to me several times in the interview, that they misunderstood the nature of the relationship, you know, the communist side.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess the communists sort of considered themselves as stability, and therefore that would be something that the Catholic Church would want to be behind.
I think you've got that. That's the case. And there was a leading communist called Stanisław Czosek. He subsequently was ambassador, Polish ambassador to Moscow. And I interviewed him several times. And he was one of the people who did a lot of talking with the church people. And, you know, you could really take from his analysis that, you know, the church, he almost thought that the church had let them down, you know. It's just always important to remember, I think, when analysing, you know, historical events, that at the end of the day, it's about human beings forming relationships that allow them to do some kind of business together. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in relation to Lech Wałęsa, and whether or not, you know, he was or wasn't in some way compromised by association with the secret police. You can be a purist. Anyone who talked to, you know, any of these church people who spoke to the communist hierarchy could be seen to be, you know, besmirched. Generally, what those people, in my view, were trying to do was to negotiate small steps at a time. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, of course, relationships of some sort developed. And I certainly know that in the case of Adam Michnik, at some level, there was some warmth from him towards General Jaruzelski. And I think you can see that pattern of the personal touching people from very, 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 very different sides of the camp. And I think that argument holds as much for the churchmen as it does for, as I said, the likes of Adam Michnik. At the end of the day, people can make deals and produce ends when they trust. And trust is at the heart of what that round table was about. And it's at the heart probably of why the likes of Adam Michnik would have defended Jaruzelski, because a promise is a promise.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.